Hey everybody, welcome back to another Monday. You know what that means? It's time for another episode of RFRX, your prescription for coping. So welcome back. I'm your host, I'm Kara. My voice has returned like 90%, so yay, medicine and science. I'm feeling better and can speak now. And I am joined by our lovely co-host, Helen Green. Helen, how are you doing today?
I am doing all right. It is Monday, best night of the week, so I'm excited to get this thing going because one of my favorite people is here.
Yes, I am super pumped about that as well, so I cannot wait. So we will not linger longer. We will go ahead and get started. So, without any further ado, Helen, would you like to introduce our guest?
Yes, so I am going to introduce one of my favorite people. Richard Gilver is a producer for the Atheist Community of Austin's Talk Heathen show. As well as producing the show, he is one of the regular hosts, as well as occasionally hosting the nonprofits and performing various other roles as an ACA volunteer. He also has a show on ACA's TikTok profile called Exploring Belief every Tuesday, where he invites guests up to discuss their beliefs in gods, the supernatural, and non-normative claims. He is in the process of putting together a website that will bring together all the work he does in skepticism and religious studies in one place, and he's currently putting together a proposal for a book about skepticism, as well as having plans for books specifically in the area of religious studies. Man, you are expanding your repertoire, my friend. So, thanks for being here, Richard.
Hello, thank you for having me. I am full of cold, and I must preempt anything I say with that. So if I need to kind of go into a coughing fit or sneeze, I will mute myself as quickly as possible, so you don't all have to bear witness to that. So yeah, thank you for having me. I love it here, and
Well,
that was
thank you for
very,
coming back. We're
yeah, it was
excited to have
very.
you back.
Very, very excited to be asked back, and I know there was a bit of jiggery pokery going off with the scheduling, so thank you for accommodating me. Because my scheduling is awful at the minute. I just have no time for anything.
We're
Well,
flexible
we
people here.
yes, and we're glad you made time for us because we are super pumped to have you back. And I have been saying for months now, we need somebody to come on and talk about cognitive bias. We have had several awesome and really fun episodes with Rob about logical fallacies. And I feel like cognitive bias is kind of like, I don't want to say the other side of that coin, but it's another piece of it, right? It's an important thing to be thinking about. And I feel like we sometimes forget to think about that. It's always fun to kind of think about, aha, I've identified a flaw in someone's reasoning, but what about biases that can affect our own thinking and lead us down the wrong path of conclusions that we probably shouldn't have come to. So I was so excited when Helen told me that you were going to talk about that. So yay.
Yeah, it happens all the time as well. I do it. There's always a point with myself where I kind of something'll happen, and in my own head, I kind of stop myself, and I become aware of, right, I've got the opportunity here now to kind of stop and think about this, or just carry on barging down the road and knocking everything out of the way and be wrong. And I usually go the wrong way. And I think most of us do. It's just a natural part of how our brains work. But I think it's important when you I don't see how we, when we get that notification, that little internal notification, that little voice saying, I might be wrong here. And sometimes it's subtle, and sometimes it's a little bit more gross. But some, on all occasions, I think certainly for me, it's something that we have to practice to be more aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. It is not something that comes naturally. I know my brain does not like to constantly be thinking, I wonder how I might be wrong. I'm usually kind of trying to do the opposite of that, but that doesn't help us be more correct, does it?
No, not at all. And it's a frustrating flaw that we have, I think.
It is. And so maybe for people that haven't heard much about it before, can you explain a little bit about like what is cognitive bias? How does that work? How do we know if it's happening?
Ooh, lot
Yeah, that's a lot of questions all at once. Maybe just start with the first one. What is it?
cognitive bias is essentially, I don't know how to exactly define it. It's that part of us which, for whatever reason, and there are many, many, many different scenarios and different biases that we have, and I'll go into some of them specifically later. But it's kind of that thing where we are going to affirm the thing that favors us, whether it can be something huge, like it can be research we're doing, which I'll talk about a little bit later on, where we're kind of, you know, as the poll question, one of the poll questions we have today, which asks about the people we're following, the research we're doing, and the studies we're doing. Do we follow the kind of the people we favor in doing research, or do we kind of apply the same overall charity to everybody, whether they're kind of on our side of the fence or not in the work we're doing? Mm-hmm. So in my field, it's really just studies. I'm an atheist. If I'm reading sort of religious author, do I put less stock in what they're saying because they're religious? And any possible biases they might have, I've got to be aware of, as well as monitoring my own bias when looking into their work. And it can be simple stuff like kind of, there's one which is, I think is it the burying your head bias, which is basically things that you kind of come across in life where you don't want to hear it, and you just kind of stick your head in the sand and go la 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 and pretend it's not there, and mm-hmm. you know, so it can come in lots and lots of different forms, but it is essentially favoring something over something else without good reason to do it, I think is the best way to put it, the most simple way to do it.
I like that. That is very kind of simplified, but yeah, that's great. So it's like your brain is kind of protecting you from information that you might not want to know about or don't want to have to believe is true in some cases, kind of taking shortcuts from actually fully evaluating all of this information that's coming in and in favor of this sounds like what I want to be true. Let's keep going forward with that, basically.
And there are reasons why we do it. I said earlier it's our brain making mistakes, but there are evolutionary reasons why that happens. So it's kind of a weird two-edged sword. Maybe in this day and age where there isn't a tiger sat in a bush waiting to bite our arms off, it's maybe we don't need it as much, and it's more of a hindrance in a lot of cases than use. But it certainly has its uses. They have their uses from an evolutionary perspective.
Oh, go ahead, Helen.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I was just going to say it must have like a social aspect to it too, because if we're usually surrounded with people that think similar to us, and to get outside information that doesn't jive with your in-group, so it also shows that social function of agreement and closeness and camaraderie, where like if you get a bias that doesn't jive with what you know. You know, you might double down because you don't want to be on the out group.
Yeah, I think in that case, again, it's something that can be useful when we're trying to find community and things. It's good to be kind of attracted to people who think the same as you. And it's that fine balance between that useful point of it and the kind of the negative aspects where we go lean too heavy the other way and start believing things. You know, this is how conspiracy theories start. We start believing conspiracy theories because we start leaning too heavily the other way and believing things without good reason to do so. So it has a utilitarian kind of aspect to it, but we've got to monitor it as well. And I think that's what makes it so interesting. I think that because it's not just a bad thing we should, and I think a lot of people, I think we do think of it like that, a lot in kind of, especially when we're trying to be pretend to be academic. We're kind of like, oh, I'm not biased, and you have this kind of, and you put, I'm really good at separating things, and I'm really good at doing this, and it has that negative aspect to it, where we've got to be aware of it, and it can be a bad thing, but it is also useful in everyday life. It's the way our brains work, and essentially. So we've got to, you know, accept that and sometimes embrace it and use it for good rather than evil.
Before you say your point, Cara, I just want, because we didn't say this at the beginning, but if you want to ask a question in the chat, please preface it with the word question and then type your question. So, and then we collect those, or if Richard sees something that he wants to answer in the chat, we can do it that way too. So, you know, I'm just putting it out there, you know, as a reminder.
Yes, thank you for that reminder, Helen. I forgot to mention that. Yes, please ask questions. We need those for the Q&A. Yeah. I thought that was a really good point you were making, Richard, about, you know, how it's not something that's wrong necessarily with our brains. Like, we encounter all kinds of information all day, every day. We can't possibly sit down and process every single bit of information that's coming in great detail. And so our brains take shortcuts, right? We have ways of sorting through information and attending to some things, deciding, this deserves my attention, and maybe this other thing I'm going to ignore, or, okay, this seems likely, I'm going to believe that, versus, this doesn't match with my kind of mental map of the world. Like, it is important for us to be able to sort through information quickly and mostly effectively, right? So it's not like something to be embarrassed about, to find out, oh no, cognitive bias, that couldn't possibly happen to me, I'm too smart for that, I'm too good for that. No, it's, your brain is working if you're taking these shortcuts. That's just part of good mental function. So we don't have to be embarrassed about, you know, oh no, cognitive bias, that couldn't possibly happen to me. Yes, it can. Yes, it does. And let's talk about it, right?
Yeah. But one of my favorite cognitive biases, and I think it's the one that illustrates cognitive biases on the whole really well, is one called the survivorship bias. And it's the survivor bias, it might be, don't remember the exact name of it. And essentially it was kind of, they came upon it when planes were coming back from war. I don't remember which war it was. I think it was World War II. And they were trying to figure out why so many planes were going down. And the planes were coming back, and there were certain areas where the planes were heavily damaged. And they were trying to think, well, they're getting shot a lot in these places, so we need to heavily armor these places, because this is where the planes are getting shot because of all the bullet holes. And somebody figured out rather cleverly that wasn't where you needed to put the extra armor on the planes, because these were the planes that were surviving that had been shot in these places. The ones that you needed to put the armor was, you know, weren't coming back at all. So the ones that were getting shot in wherever it was, the wings or whatever, they didn't need extra armor in those places because they were actually surviving. And I love that one. I think that's a perfect example of what a cognitive bias is.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. So people were assuming that they were looking at a full representative sample when in fact they weren't. They were looking at the things that they didn't need to fix.
Yeah, and I've just noticed that Rob has confirmed that it was World War II as well in the chat. So yeah, thank you for that, Rob.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. So, I mean, that sounds like that has pretty broad applicability to our life. Just like that one bias, if we were aware of that, we could probably avoid all sorts of errors.
Yeah.
I love that.
I do. That's my favorite of, I think that's my favorite of all of them, just because it is so, like, it's one of those ones where you don't think about it until it's explained to you, and then you're like, wow.
Yeah. Have you had any personal experience where you were able to apply that or some of the other ones to a problem that you were having or a thought that you had where you realized, oh, hey, this is that bias, let me avoid that?
Do you know what? I don't know, because I don't tend to frame things that way. So I couldn't name a particular bias. I do fall prey to biases all the time, But I don't think this, I don't think I kind of go through and say, oh, this is bias A or bias B and kind of like apply it in that manner. So I think it's a lot more subtle than that. Are we? Oh,
I am so sorry. I'm eating. I didn't realize my microphone was on. So I apologize.
It's okay. We were enjoying your meal. No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
We couldn't
hear you. I'm glad. All right. But that is really that point you make where you're going through the cognitive bias and you're not sitting there going like, this is point A and this is point B. Let me dissect it. You know, you usually go with the one that gives you the pleasure, you know, the thing that makes you feel good, you know, because that's comfortable, you know, rather than, you know, going, well, let me dissect this, you know.
Yeah, I think we do. I think we can dissect it. We just don't. I don't think we kind of sit there and do it analytically. I think we just become aware that we're doing it and kind of changed. If we become aware and we want to change tact, we change tact. Sometimes we don't want to. Sometimes we like being biased and the feeling it gives us, because a lot of them make us feel good and we want to feel superior, especially when we're in conversation with other people. We're very good at going, you've done this, but I'm immune to it, which is total rubbish, of course.
I know. I try and catch myself and stop myself from doing that too. It's so exciting to be able to find the error in other people's reasoning. But we can turn that back on ourselves too. Yeah. Yeah, exactly, Dan. Yeah, how can those of us without any cognitive biases fix all those other people? Right. Yeah, that's the thing to avoid for sure. But so how did you kind of become aware of this or get involved in, you know, thinking about identifying cognitive biases, and how is that important to your life and your work, and all need to incorporate it too?
You keep asking, you keep gish galloping me a million good questions at once, Cara.
sorry. You'd think I'd be able to do one at a time after having been doing this show for a while.
How did I first become aware of it? I might ask you to repeat some of these once I've addressed one. So how did I become aware? I think I just read, I enjoy reading psychology and neurology stuff. And it just becomes apparent when you kind of get into that sphere of things that, you know, this is something we do. And my wife has got, I think I've mentioned before that my wife has got many degrees in many different areas, and one of her master's degrees in educational psychology. So she's very quick to point out when I'm making biases. So we are. It's great fun, yeah. So you know, I think having an interest in that field, and you know, there are some great books. I think I've put some recommendations in. On, I think you asked me about some recommendations when we did the kind of pre-show stuff, and I put some books on the subject. And there's one of the ones I put on, but there's one by Daniel Kahneman called Thinking Fast and Slow, and I think he's an economist, if I remember correctly, but he's done some great work, like Nobel Prize work on biases and stuff. And that book is really, really good. And to the point where I've had conversations with other people in the skeptic community about some of the things he's said, and they've like really, really fought against me, because it's so, some biases, these aren't necessarily biases, but it's all related, but some things are counterintuitive and we don't like to hear it. And I think, you know, sometimes it's good to sit back, and that book's really, really good at doing that, making you sit back and think, I am making many mistakes with the way I'm thinking and operating. And it's just good to be aware of it.
Excellent. Okay, yeah, and I'll drop that link into the chat too. Yeah, that one's actually on my Goodreads list of things that I want to read.
That isn't on your Goodreads list, Cara, really.
You know, after doing this show for this long, no, I think my Goodreads list is pretty much completely full, but there may be books that have yet to make it onto the list, and I want to know about them. Send me your recommendations. I need more books.
This is what over-education does to you children.
It is this. You just continually read books forever. And then you have all these thoughts going around in your head. And you're like, I think I read this somewhere. Or did you tell me? Or did I dream that? I don't know anymore. But, you know, what can you do? But moving on from that, tell us more about how cognitive bias or being aware of cognitive bias has helped you in terms of being a better skeptic or in your other work.
Yeah, I mean, in skepticism, it's important to be aware of these things because we are essentially, you know, looking at the best way of investigating the world. And we've got to be aware of biases when we do that, or we're going to fall prey to them, you know, ourselves. And I think for me, one of the essential things, which kind of encompasses lots of biases, is framing, the way we frame things, and that's tremendously important, I think, when making mistakes and biases. And I think the easiest way to kind of understand framing is to ask the question kind of, what are the chances of winning the lottery? Just that question, what are the chances of winning the lottery? And that depends entirely, that question depends entirely your frame of reference. Because are we asking, what are the chances of me as an individual winning the lottery? Or are we asking, what are the chances of someone winning the lottery? Or are we asking, what are the chances of someone winning the jackpot? Or are we asking, what are the chances of someone winning any prize? And the specifics, the framing of this question is really, really important. And I think, you know, the chances of me as an individual winning the jackpot lottery are tiny, very, very small. But the chances of someone winning any level of prize are exceptionally large. And yet this all falls under the kind of question, what are the chances of winning the lottery? And we see this framing mistake all the time when we're talking to kind of religious people and things. And, you know, let's not assume that we're not immune to it when I say that as well. But we do, you know, I was recently talking to a Christian who believed that we couldn't say that it was probable that there was life and other life in the universe. And he actually used a similar argument to the question I've just asked about the lottery, but he used the example of a craps table in a casino. And his mistake was to misunderstand probability. And this is a great thing that Daniel Kahneman's book touches on quite a lot as well. And he was making a mistake of framing. And the kind of thing, the way he put it was to say that something is probable is wildly different than saying it is possible. It's possible that I can go to the casino and win 20 million at the craps table, but we know that it's highly unlikely and therefore not probable. So I stepped in and I corrected him by saying, I think it was something like, you know, no one is saying that there is a high likelihood of a specific planet containing life. And the argument is that it's probable that there is intelligent life given the totality of planets. So likewise, the chances of you individually winning the craps table are improbable. Just like it's improbable pulling a single planet and saying it will have developed life. But if we take the sum of all craps players, it's probable that a proportion of them will win the 20 million. In fact, it's almost a certainty given all the games of craps that are played and that prize being a possible prize. And that's the same for the planets developing life. Given the availability of a 20 million prize, it's probable that a proportion of players from the sum of all players will win it. Given the availability that life can develop on planets, it's probable that a planet from the sum of all planets will develop it. And it's the way he framed the argument that was the mistake. It wasn't necessarily that his example was wrong in a certain framing, but the specific question we were asking, he was making a mistake based on that framing. And I think that's really, that to me is one of the overarching, it's a huge, huge thing that covers a lot of the things we talk about, especially when we're talking to people who, you know, theists or people who believe in the supernatural. You know, the Christians, a lot of made statements such as the Bible is reliable. Now, that again, it's framing. It's reliable for what? What's the reference point? Is it reliable for a guide as believers? Reliable as a history book? Reliable as a source of Christian belief? Is it, you know, all these questions have got a different answer.
So to piggyback off of that, I want to go over the poll results.
Yeah, because... let me go ahead and launch those so we can all see them. Here we go. Go ahead.
Okay. So would you be more inclined to believe an academic scholar if their worldview matched your own? So 69% said yes. 6% said no, and 25% said not sure. I think that yes is a huge jump, and that was something that I wanted to kind of touch on as we go forward. And then number two, how good do you think you are at identifying your own cognitive biases? One, I don't even know what cognitive bias is, which was at 3%. Poor at 9%. Okay, you know, at 63%, pretty good at 25%, and I can almost always catch it, which was zero. So I wanted to go over the results of, are you more inclined to believe an academic scholar if their worldview matches your own? Because you talked about this the last show you were on, talking about, you know, your religious studies, and that not every scholar that you read like shares the same worldview that you have and shares your lack of belief. So how do people get over that? Like even people that are masters in their field aren't going to have the same worldview as you do.
I think we've just got to be aware of it. And we do have, you know, atheists do make that, you know, if, you know, with the example I've just given with the Bible, you know, how many times have you heard an atheist say that the Bible is unreliable? Because I hear it all the time. I've done it myself. And, you know, we do make that same framing mistake, then, you know, that we have to be aware of. And I think it's just a case of, I hate this term because it's genuinely a load of crap that when we apply it in its normal way, but it's brain training. We've got to try and train ourselves to be aware of these things when they're coming up. And, you know, the kind of example I use, and I feel awful doing it because it's not a disrespect to the particular scholar himself, but Dr. Bart Ehrman is always mentioned by atheists in atheist circles as, you know, oh, go and read Ehrman's work. You know, he's brilliant, and he is brilliant. He's really, really good. But why aren't you saying the same about John Drane? Of, you know, John Drane, I've got an undergraduate book by Dr. Bart Ehrman about how the New Testament was put together. I've also got one by John Drane, who's a Christian scholar. And the books are almost identical in the conclusions. And I think, you know, why are we leaning towards this agnostic scholar when there's so many good religious scholars out there? That we can also touch on and use, you know, why are we saying, well, this guy's an agnostic, he doesn't believe in God, and therefore he is my go-to source. He's a good scholar, and as I say, I want to kind of preface that with that I don't have anything against him, but it's just I think it's a very important kind of thing that we need to do, and maybe in casual conversation as people on message boards and things, it's maybe not quite as important. But, you know, when we get into serious kind of study of religion, I think it's a very, very important point to note. And that again, that transition between, because you talk on these things, you know, and we have a range of people in our community with various levels of kind of knowledge on different subjects. You know, I can't talk on being a family doctor as my friend Dr. Ben can, and there are people in our community who aren't well versed in kind of religious education and religious scholarship, but we hear them talking about it on, you know, very many occasions. And how many of them are committing biases towards, you know, the atheist side of scholarship? It's something we've got to watch out for. And that's not a negative thing, because we all do it. I'm not picking on anyone in particular, but we all do it. We all do it. And I think we've got to be aware of it. And the best way to be aware of it is to practice being aware of it. To be open to kind of, when we're reading these things, saying, am I agreeing with this because I am naturally inclined to agree with it? Or am I agreeing with it because it's good work, and the work that's been put in is good, and there is little bias in it? There's a religious scholar, I forget his name. I think it's Luke Timothy Johnson. And
well, that's a very biblical sounding name.
He's said openly that he does not agree with the consensus of scholars when he's teaching about the authorship of the Gospels. He thinks the four Gospels were authored by the four people who they're attributed to. And he openly admits, and this is the sign of a good scholar, he openly admits that he doesn't follow the consensus of scholarship, but when he's teaching, he teaches with the consensus of scholarship, despite his personal opinion. And I think that's very, very important. And that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of awareness we need to have when we're doing this work, that we need to really sit down and say, am I being biased when I'm looking at this? And it's so hard to do. Especially if we're like, and you know, anybody who's done any kind of academic schooling whatsoever will know that you're not like reading a novel that you're heavily invested in. You're going trying to find a point that backs up your argument a lot of times, you know, because you've got essays to write and things, and you want to make a point and you want to do it as quickly as possible. And it's so easy, especially in doing that, to kind of directly focus on the thing you want and ignore the rest, the surrounding material. And sometimes I think we just have to say, we need to slow down. Let's stop. We've found this point. Let's read around it. You know, going back to the Bible as an example, you know, I hear a lot, or the Quran or anything, I hear a lot of people when they're kind of criticizing it, saying, you know, but it says this. And so many times, and they're not always necessarily wrong, but so many times I want to say, make sure you read the surrounding stuff. Make sure you read the context and understand the context. And how are you, again, coming back? I'm going to come back to framing throughout this conversation, because I think that is so vitally important for everything. You know, again, coming back to framing, are you reading it just to criticize it? Are you reading it from the perspective and have an understanding of the perspective of the people who likely wrote it? Are you reading it as a historical document? Are you reading it from the perspective of the people you're criticizing, the believers, when you're having these conversations? All these things should be considered when we're having these conversations. And when you're taking, you know, I do work on call-in shows for the ACA, and when you're taking calls, and you're talking to someone, and the first inkling you've got of what they want to talk about is when you see those call screeners notes come up, and you might have a couple of minutes between having a quick glance at the notes and actually talking to these people. And, you know, you're trying to legitimately kind of have a genuine, honest conversation with them and kind of go into that. But at the same time, be so careful about not making mistakes. And I make mistakes all the time on those shows. You know, if you read through the comment sections after, and people have picked up on little things that you've said, and you know, I'll always read the comment sections. And if someone's pointed out a genuine mistake I've made, then I'll be the first person to say, yeah, you know, I did make a mistake there. Either this is what I meant, or it was just a mistake. You know, other times I don't. Other times I say, well, no, you're wrong. I was absolutely right all along. But, you know, it's just being aware, just being opening yourself to the awareness that you can be wrong when you're doing this. And I love it. I think that to me is as exciting as having the conversations. Anyway, I'm enthusiastic about kind of relaying skepticism to people. But skepticism starts at home, kids. And yep. we're not immune to making mistakes ourselves. And this is the very, very important thing for me. You know, if we're going to talk about biases, if we're going to talk about mistakes we make, start with ourselves and monitor ourselves. Do it at home, and then you can recognize when other people doing it properly rather than just recognizing when other people doing it because you want to make a point that they're wrong. I've been talking for ages. I'm going to show them now.
I mean, that's what we invited you here for, so it's okay. I mean,
Tara and I talk all the time, but
we do.
Yeah, but not in this context. Anyway, so do you think, and this is just something that popped into my brain, you were talking, that people that grew up in religious communities are taught that what they believe is the correct answer. And through coming to disbelief and things like that, you kind of you deal with that cognitive dissonance. But do you think part of that doubling down is, for some people, whether it be a political view, religious view, worldview, something like that, that because they were taught like this is correct, it may be hard for them to deal with that discomfort compared to us that have learned to be skeptical and be like, well, I might be right, I might be wrong. Let me, you know, please correct me. And then, you know, if you're really interested, do a follow up to make sure that, you know, the information presented to you was correct.
Yeah, I think that's largely a part of it, that, you know, they grow up with a particular worldview or have been told that this is the right answer. And, you know, when that happens to you, you know, you're inclined to believe it's the right answer, especially if you've had it from a young age. You know, it maybe it's kind of less so if you kind of, I don't know, because I've never been a religious person, so I may be speaking uneducatedly here, but maybe if you come to it later in life and you're kind of looking into it yourself and making those choices yourself, maybe not so much. But yeah, if you've been brought up as from a young age believing things, I think it happens to all of us. I remember being at school a long time ago, back in the early 80s. And I think this was the first time I ever thought about anything like this. And I must have only been 6 or 7 years old. But it's traumatized me that much. I still remember it to this day. And that's when I found out that they were first saying that the Diplodocus might not have been an actual dinosaur and they were renaming it. And that traumatized me. And I was like, this is something I'd been taught. I'd been looking at these like child-friendly books full of pictures of Diplodoci. Is it Diplodoci or Diplodocus? I don't know, and I don't care.
I missed that one in school.
You know, and you know, these pictures of these dinosaur books telling you about the Tyrannosaurus Rex and all the different dinosaurs. And there was a Diplodocus in there, and then all of a sudden, the teachers were saying that maybe the Diplodocus didn't exist. You know, scientists are thinking of calling it something else. And maybe it didn't look like we think it looked like. And that traumatized me. And that was the first time I ever I was challenged that something I took to be read, that something I'd been taught as being true, may not actually be true. And I think, so yeah, especially when we're young and we grow up in something, being told something is true is very powerful to us. And it's very hard to accept when that thing is challenged.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of part of your, I mean, I guess, ontological security almost, this idea that, you know, I know things that are real and this is true and this is consistent and I can feel secure in this knowledge and I don't have to be walking around, you know, not knowing what's going to happen to me when I die, or, you know, that this unexpected thing could occur. And that's really jarring to find something out that you thought was true, that you took from a good authority. Somebody mentioned in the chat about Pluto not being a planet anymore. And I feel like that too. Like, yeah, we've been seeing pictures of the solar system in our science textbooks since, you know, we were little kids. And that's upsetting to find a mistake. It feels like, you know, oh, what if everything's unraveling? What if nothing is true? It can be a little bit panic inducing. But at the same time, though, I mean, I think the point you're making is that it doesn't have to be scary if you're coming at it from the perspective of, oh, we've actually learned something new. Now we know more than we did previously, right?
I think it's going to be scary. I think you've had my friend Professor Richard Firth, God be here, and I'm going to call him Professor because I got told off last time I called him Doctor. Professor Richard Firth, God be here, was on here, and he will say it, and absolutely he's right that, you know, everything we do, and this is another thing that kind of atheists and skeptics don't like to hear, that all of us use emotion in things. We're not pure logic machines. And, you know, emotion is a very important way that we assess the world. And yeah, I don't, you know, we're going to be upset when we're challenged on things. That doesn't mean we can't be excited at the same time. You know, one of my favorite, I don't watch many content creators on YouTube. And one of the ones I do watch is an astrophysicist called Dr. Becky. And she's very enthusiastic, shall we say, about her field of study. And, you know, when things are challenged, she's done a lot of videos about the James Webb Telescope, discovering things that we didn't previously know, which challenge the way we think about some things. And she gets very excited, and I love that. I think that's a brilliant thing about science, because we can be challenged about, you know, the paradigms and the things that we actually think are true. And that's so exciting. Yes, it's scary. Yes, it elicits that emotional response of, and sometimes like fear, where we don't want to leave that thing that we find secure. But at the same time, it's so exciting that, you know, these things can happen and can be challenged. And that's what kind of empiricism and things allow us to do if we use that as a way of assessing the world. Of course, it's much more difficult when you assess the world through a religious lens and you've been told this is the absolute truth and cannot be challenged. That's where it becomes hard, and that's where I think a lot of dissonance comes in, because you have this conflicting, I think certainly a lot of people I talk to who are religious have this kind of underlying secrets. I don't want to do an apologist thing and say that you all secretly believe in God, but I think that some of them secretly know that, you know, what the kind of arguing isn't the case. But it's just hard for them to let go. It's hard for them to get that part of the brain, which is so convinced, to let go of that emotion, to say, you know, maybe this is the way that it actually is. And that need not stop them being religious. But, you know, just reassess the framing. I might just get pictures and frame them. And because it's so important. It's so, so important. Look, everything's a frame. We've got squares behind me. Everything's a frame. It's so, so important in everything we do. And it informs all of this, the framing at which we look at things.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it kind of reminded me too of something we've talked about before. You know, you were saying, you know, growing up learning that this cannot be questioned, and you have the truth, you have the answers, this is all the information we need, this is it, and it can't be questioned. And sometimes, like, I know this happened for me, and I've seen this happen to other people too. I caught myself doing it, you know, shortly after I deconverted, where you do kind of grow up with this mindset of thinking, okay, you just have to find the thing that's true, and then you believe that and you have the truth. And it can be really tempting once you find out, oh, okay, actually, I don't believe in this religious text anymore, you know, for all of these various reasons. You know, I've determined that, you know, probably a snake did not in fact trick someone into eating a piece of fruit, and that's why we're all here now, or whatever the case may be. But it's really easy to carry that way of thinking over to the next thing. And then all of a sudden, okay, I don't believe that book anymore, but now I'm going to follow this YouTube influencer, or I read this one book by a skeptic, and now this is the inerrant truth that fell down from heaven and it cannot be questioned, and everyone who thinks differently is wrong. And again, you're just stopping yourself from learning anything new. But it's hard. Sometimes it's easier to switch the thing you believe than that mindset that's making you not want to question things, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, I know Helen did an excellent talk on here, which I will praise forever and a day, about kind of...
Give me compliments. Give them to me. From my ego.
about coming out of religion and taking up a different paradigm and kind of running with that. And I think it's an easy way to transition. It frustrates the hell out of me as someone who's never been religious, because I want somebody to just lose magical thinking altogether straight away and become a skeptic. But of course it doesn't happen. You know, everybody I talk to who has been religious says, yeah, I had a stage where I wasn't religious, but I believed in something. And that transitional stage. So yeah, absolutely, people swap one paradigm for another. And, you know, don't necessarily lose the way they're thinking. They just swap it for something else, which might be a little bit more comfortable on the journey that they're on. And again, mm-hmm. I want to stress that's not a bad thing. I keep saying, you know, I keep putting these caveats in. But I think this is an emotive subject for people of both sides. You know, and you'll probably notice throughout this, I've been switching from religious people do this to we as skeptics do this. Because it's important to note that it's not just those outsiders who do it. We do it ourselves. You know, a mistake we make as atheists when we're having discussions, and I use that as a frame of reference, because, you know, I have a lot of these conversations in this community, and I'm not just someone who's kind of working through things for myself personally. And I think another mistake we make as atheists is to dismiss any other ways of thinking outright. And religious people pick up on this, and it has to be said, usually make a straw man out of it. Mm-hmm. But it is very important to know atheists often dismiss things like metaphysics and philosophical proof of other ways of thinking out of hand. And I don't think we should do that, because we don't need to do that. Because we can very argue against those things by understanding the power that skepticism has to kind of address things. So we don't have to say, well, I completely dismiss philosophy. Carl Sagan does this, and I love Carl Sagan, but Carl Sagan does it in The Demon Haunted World. He completely dismisses philosophy out of hand. And I don't think you need to do that, because I think In the grand scheme of reality, you know, philosophy has its uses, and it's good for asking questions, and so is metaphysics. It's good for asking questions that kind of, lead the way to how science is working, and the questions we're asking in science and the ideas and the hypotheses we have in science are often led by kind of metaphysical questions or philosophical questions, and that they're not necessarily a bad thing. It's bad when you use it to inform kind of the answer that we can't necessarily inform through doing that. There was there's an example of why philosophical thinking or using philosophy on its own sans empiricism is a bad idea. I think the guy, David Zvezke, I think they call the professor, he's a professor of argumentation. I think it's Northwestern University it's at. And he kind of said, let me try and find the actual quote he said, because it's really good at demonstrating this point. And the essential thing while I'm looking for the quote is that no matter how kind of right the form of a formal logical argument is, it can still be counterfactual. And there it is. The quote he says is that he kind of gives the example of the moon being made of green cheese. And he says, he sets out as a syllogism, all heavenly bodies are made of green cheese. The moon is a heavenly body, therefore it is made of green cheese. It is absolutely good deductive reasoning, even though it's counterfactual. But the form of the argument itself is perfect. So deduction is analytic. It doesn't require any reference to the external world. and it can even be counterfactual. So this is what we have to be very careful when using kind of philosophy and things, because it's useful. It is useful to form an argument, to form an idea, but we have to reference it to what we can actually test with empiricism. And I think that's rather than dismissing a kind of philosophy out of hand, like Sagan does on occasion, I think it's important just to understand its flaws and kind of use, you know, the best method we have, which is empiricism, of kind of corresponding what is likely true with reality to, you know, to those arguments. Because if we apply empiricism to that argument, even though it's perfect in form, we can see that there's a massive flaw in it, and that's that the moon is not actually made of green cheese, and this is something we can test. So, you know, let's frame things and properly and understand how we're talking about things rather than just this. We don't have to dismiss things out of hand. We can argue against them, and I think that's very, very important.
And also think too, like I remember when I was in college, I took like a couple of philosophy classes, and I also took an ethics and morals class, and each feed the other, you know, because ethics and morality are abstract concepts, you know, they're not objective facts, you know, and we decide, you know, how these ethics and morals operate in human systems. And I think that that's a philosophical debate and discussion that people need to have. So yes, could I philosophize that, you know, the moon is made from cream cheese? Sure. But that doesn't have any basis in true reality, but ethics and morals do have a base in reality, but they're abstract concepts. So, you know, I think those discussions are meaningful to have. You know, yeah, we can say that, you know, it's all in the brain and there's neuroscience, but still, like, every day you have to make moral and ethical decisions, and having discussions about that and how we progress is really, really important. So I don't like to dismiss philosophy. I'm not the best philosophizer or anything, but, you know, I think those types of discussions are really, really important. And we can't just be like, screw it. I don't want to discuss this. I want to pretend it's not worthy to have it as a method of argumentation.
There's a difference between saying it's not worthy to have and saying that I don't think it's useful to discuss it. Yeah. And, you know, I heard your Helen does a show on the Atheist Community of Austin's TikTok channel on a Tuesday. What time is it, Helen?
7 p.m. Eastern. Just subscribe to the ACA on your TikTok, and I will go live, and you can hear me talk to randos.
And the first show she did was last week, and someone was talking, asked a philosophical question on there, and she said, you know, this isn't my field. I don't really want to discuss it. And that's fine. And that's what I do with biology. If anybody starts talking about evolution to me, I'm talking to the wrong person, mate. I have no clue whatsoever. I'm really, really bad in that field. I've got enough to occupy my time without taking on another full field of study. Go and talk to Forrest Valky or someone who knows what they're talking about. And it's okay to say, you know, I don't know, and I, you know, it's not my area, and I can't talk about it. That doesn't mean that the conversation is not important to have.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that we don't have to pretend to be experts in things that we're not. It's okay to say, I don't know. I can't respond to that. I'm not sure. I'll look into that. I mean, it's fine. We don't have to pretend to knowledge that we do not have. That's a lot of times what I think we tend to point out that other people are doing. But, you know, to your point, let's start
it. Google is your friend.
Yes. Google is a good friend of mine.
The all-knowing God, Google, is your friend.
Yes. Oh, and that reminds me, Helen, I wanted to ask Richard, you know, you were talking earlier on about, you know, when you're doing your research, or I hate that phrase, doing your research, but
do your research.
Do your own research. When you are consulting with your friend, the Google, and you want to learn more about a topic, this is a moment, right, when we're vulnerable or susceptible to our own biases leading us down a particular path, right? Clicking on this article rather than that article, or agreeing with this author rather than that author. And I was wondering if you could kind of walk us through some tips for, let's say that somebody brings something up that we don't know anything about, and we think, huh, I want to learn more about this. I know that I am susceptible to bias. I want to make sure that I am learning something, you know, to the best of my ability, that I'm not, you know, blinding myself to different perspectives or new ideas. What are some things that we can do when we go onto the interwebs and encounter way more information than we can possibly sort through? How can we protect ourselves from fooling ourselves with our biases?
For me, the most straightforward, quickest and easiest way of doing that is by going to the source of the source of the source. So, you know, you get things like Wikipedia, which are tremendously useful for kind of getting a rough outline of something. Not particularly useful for getting all the actual facts of things. So, you know, let's say, for example, we do a quick Google and we get a Wikipedia page up. They will always have kind of references, or they should have references to the source material. So, you know, the first thing I do if I see a particular point which I find interesting in a Wikipedia article is click on that little thing that says one or two next to it and see where that source material is. And, you know, is it a magazine article? Is it a newspaper article? Is it a scientific paper? You know, these are all very important. They bear different weights of kind of whether they're good sources or not. And do that. There's even things like I've got a set of kind of scientific monthly magazines that kind of come out with just like headline stuff. And I don't think there's one of the articles I found interesting in those magazines where I've not gone and found out the actual professors who've been, you know, referred to in those articles and actually looked at the papers from which the kind of work has been taken. And you know, have a look through those papers and see what they say, because even good kind of science communication magazines are written to sell magazines, and they will have headlines designed to grab your attention and pull you in. And you know, I think it's important to kind of go beyond that. And I think this is, you know, I mentioned Dr. Becky earlier. She's really good in astrophysics because she kind of does explain what the data means in these things. And, you know, I can't remember the specifics, but there was something came out a few months ago. I think it was it about black holes or dark matter or something? And you know, it was all over the headlines of the paper that, you know, this was a massive paradigm shift in physics and things. And she actually walked you through the data, and she's saying, you know, that all these headlines that are coming out aren't actually saying what the truth of the matter is. So, you know, go to sources that you have. Now, this is very, very borderline thing to say, but go to the sources you trust, but make sure you vet those sources before you trust them. Don't just say, that guy's an atheist, I'm an atheist, therefore he's a good source, because not always good sources. But, you know, once you've vetted a source and you know it's a good source, you know, use that source and keep returning to see if it's remaining a good source. You know, and you might hear me talk on, you might call Talk Heathen one day and hear me talk about something like Buddhism, which I've got a fair amount of knowledge in. And then the next week, someone might be having a conversation about evolution with me, which I've got no, you know, knowledge in whatsoever. So, you know, check me on the things I'm saying. Even if you trust me, even if you like listening to Richard, you know, if you like listening to Richard, if you listen to Talk Heathen and think Richard a good communicator, still check what I say. And if you think I've said something wrong, call me out on it. It's very important to do that, even the sources you trust. But yeah, if you're doing something on the internet, if you're doing research, one thing that gets me is kind of Google Scholar. Because Google Scholar is always touted as, you know, go to Google Scholar if you're doing any Google stuff. Yes and no, because Google Scholar is better than just general Google for finding sources on stuff. But that doesn't necessarily mean the sources on there are really good sources. You know, I found sources on Islamic studies before on Google Scholar, where the kind of authors of the paper have prefaced the paper, which have been criticisms of other papers about Islam. And they've prefaced the paper with, you know, this paper I'm writing about, I'm commenting on, has no authority because the person who wrote it wasn't a Muslim. So dismiss everything in it. So just because something is on Google Scholar, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a good, unbiased source. We've got to kind of check everything. And but yeah, go to the source material and assess the source material rather than just kind of taking the headline. That's how I would do it. It's the most straightforward way of doing it, especially in this fast-paced day and age where we want information right now. Give me that information now. It's vital. I'm sure clicking my fingers did wonders for the audio. Sorry, audio people. But it's, you know, don't just read the first thing you see and take it into account. Go further into it. Do that digging. Put that extra effort in. You know, you don't have to spend months and months and months verifying an entire Google article, an entire Wikipedia article. Just, you know, the bits that are relevant, check those bits. And as I said earlier, if you're reading the Bible, check the surrounding context. Go to the source material, have a look at it. And that's the easiest way to kind of get the best information we can without having, and you know, we all read stuff that in fields that we're not experts in. All of us. And you know, we've got to kind of do our best. We're not going to become an expert overnight by reading a Wikipedia article. If we're going to have these conversations and talk about things with people, it's very important. I spoke last time I was on here, I think, if I remember rightly, about realism, the Raelian movement. And you know, when that was brought up to me, I had no idea. I had to go and do research on it, and I went down a right rabbit hole with that. I found stuff from the kind of founder's ex-wife and things and newspaper articles and that, like, published in a small town. And you know, it's very, I think, going into that, and it's interesting going down those rabbit holes. I'm going totally off track here, but stop me if I need to be stopped. There's an area near where I live, which is famous for its hauntings. The story goes that there were two security guards who saw a group of children in Victorian dress, dancing around an electricity pile and singing Ring a Ring of Roses. And every single time I have heard this story, I have heard the same thing. And I actually did a little bit of digging on it, and I found it was buried. It took me, I think, about 3 days of solid searching to find any statement from the actual security guards who were there. And I found a statement, and I think he'd emigrated to Canada. And from one of the security guards, and he said that never happened. But yet, every single time I hear this story repeated, it's the same thing. These two security guards saw these things, and it was so intense for them that this, that, and the other. And you know, the only reference I can find to it from the horse's mouth said it didn't happen. But you've got to dig for that stuff. Sometimes it's not ever present right in front of your nose. And we live in a world with mice, not like that kind of mouse, not the squeaky kind of mice, and internet and Google and instant gratification. And you know, it's very, very easy to fall prey to false information if you can't be bothered to do the legwork. Don't do your research in a flat earth way. Vet your sources.
Okay, but it makes me feel good to be right.
Well, and that's the dangerous part too about having this much information online, where, I mean, the clickbait is counting on that. They're counting on you clicking on the article that makes you feel good or enraged or whatever it is, because they're playing on these biases, right? And I know I'm using they rather liberally here, but content creators, media sources are counting on us, wanting to click on the thing that makes us feel good and makes us feel right and correct. And yes, this is reinforcing my belief, rather than actually questioning or challenging our beliefs or thinking through, wait, do I have this right? Is there maybe a group of people who have a perspective on this that I haven't heard from yet? And we have to do that work, because the internet is not going to do that work for us.
Yeah. I'm a great advocate for if I've said anything that's wrong, call me out on it. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, I'll say it on a weekly basis when I do talk, Ethan, if anyone in the comments has any problem with anything I've said, call me out on it and I'll respond to it. And someone actually called up Talk Ethan a few weeks ago and said they had a problem with something that I'd said, and we ironed it out there and then on air. And, you know, I'll absolutely do that. Mm-hmm. If you think I'm wrong on something, because I want to know I'm wrong. If I am wrong, and yeah. You know, let me know. Please
don't let us be out here on the internet saying silly things. Like, someone stop me.
And also too, that when you get corrected, yes, it might upset you. I was corrected a couple nights ago and it upset me, you know, but after but then after I sat there and I listened to the person explain why I was wrong, I was like, you know what? I have to adjust my thinking on this, you know, and then I learned to let it go. And I think that's the harder part, is sitting with the discomfort and that it might upset you, because you've been walking around for 20 years with this idea in your head. And then somebody says, like, no, actually, blah, 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 blah. You know, and it changes your perception of something. It's going to feel not great, you know, but if you really want to learn, you have to get used to being uncomfortable, you know, and sometimes the things that we hold dear to isn't necessarily true.
Yeah, that's very important, you know, and we said earlier about the, you know, using the moon being made of cheese example, you know, how do we remedy the fact that, you know, we have different frames of references and things, you know? Well, you can have a theist and an atheist both making perfectly formed arguments that contradict each other. And, you know, so what frame of reference do we use to get to the truth? And, you know, that is, what is it that corresponds to our shared reality? And this is, shared reality is a thing I talk about a lot. I may not have time to go into it here, but I think it's important to this whole conversation. But we use empiricism. We can test whether the moon is made of cheese or not. You know, if you listen to virtually any deductive argument that makes a claim about reality, this is what happens. The arguments aren't usually about the form of, you know, the arguments against the arguments aren't usually about the form, although, you know, if we go to the Kalam, it usually is. But in general, it's not, there's lots of arguments that have really, really good form. It's not usually about the form. It's almost always about whether the content of the argument corresponds to the shared reality that we have. And it's almost always empiricism that gives us, if possible, that information. And I think this is what I was talking about earlier when I was saying we can combat these other paradigms without having to dismiss them entirely, because we can point out that, yeah, you can make the argument that the moon is made of green cheese, but, you know, you're not going to find out whether that is true or likely true just by simply making the argument. We need to test it. We can test it. We have tested it. And the way we tested it was through empiricism. And I think that's very, very important. But, you know, how long have we got left? Because I could talk about this stuff for a year.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was going to say it is getting close to time to start thinking about moving to Q&A. So if you do have any kind of final points to
I want to go into when I was kind of formulating what I was going to talk about, I kind of headlined something, the human brain is shit, which is a favorite saying of mine. We even made a t-shirt out of it when I did the old Skeptic Hangout podcast. You know, interpreting reality can be a problem because we have to use our senses, and on a collective scale, this doesn't cause us too many issues, I don't think. And here comes the framing again, because our shared reality en masse, we can self-correct and do. And we've invented methods and instruments that help us to do that. you know, that give us yardsticks by which we can kind of assess our individual reality against the whole. It's why I have corrective lenses and don't constantly bump into walls.
Because are those corrective lenses in frames?
Yes, they are indeed, as is everything. Were I to be the only person alive on the world, I would take my short-sightedness as standard vision, because I'd have no yardstick by which to go by. And my sample size of one, it would be normal, but we have this kind of shared reality that we have with other beings where we can correct things. And, you know, the way that things, you know, if we look at psychology, which I'm not sure what your background is, Kari, but I think that's Helen's background. So, you know, help me along if I make any mistakes here.
Yeah, I did an undergraduate degree in psychology, which means I know just enough to be dangerous and get things mixed up.
Well, if I make any mistakes here, someone please correct me, because as I said earlier, I don't have any degrees in psychology yet. It is on the maybe on the horizon, but I mean it's a subject I'm interested in, and in psychology they talk about sensation and perception, and sensation is that which describes the physical input of the environment, so that stuff which is received by our sensory receptors, them things under their ears, and perception is the way in which we make sense of that information. So sensations are largely the same. So we can all smell bread, but our perceptions of that smell are different. And it depends on, again, framing, are we hungry? Do we have pleasant memories of smelling bread from our childhood, et cetera, et cetera? And our brain takes this information and organizes it and filters it and chooses the bits that it thinks are useful from those that it doesn't. And this can be influenced by, again, mood levels of tiredness and all sorts of other different things. And the difficulty is that there is a lot of information coming in all at once. And that takes a lot of filtering to do. And I think more importantly, the brain doesn't just make a kind of a picture world using this information. It also has what's called in neurology, the internal model. So in short, it's already built up a picture of what is out there in reality based on previous experience. And when it receives the new information from the sense organs, it cross-references as all that stuff that's coming in with that internal model that we've already got. So for example, if we're walking around a familiar room with kind of lights on, there isn't much going on. The internal model and external stimuli match up. There's less margin for error. And the brain is doing less work. However, if we are in an unfamiliar place in the dark with little new information from our sense organs, and our internal model is still as active and still trying to cross-reference that external data. But when there isn't any or very little, when we're in an unfamiliar place and it's dark and things like that, then it will form a picture of the world anyway. And if we're presupposed to believing in, let's say, ghosts and ghouls, we're more inclined to imagine that this little bit of light we've seen, or that little knock, well, we've got an explanation to hand because we've already got that internal model that our brains created. And like I said earlier, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. We owe the survival of our species to such cognitive illusions. It's better to overinterpret coincidences and flee rather than to stand there and try and work out what that noise behind the tree was and get eaten by a bear. But largely, as I said earlier, we don't need that now. And we still have it. And, you know, where we don't see a bear that isn't there, we construct something else instead. And that doesn't have to be an external foe. It can be a runaway train of conspiracy thinking. And it can have ever more elaborate layers of explanation. It can be based on our shared reality. For example, the Twin Towers came down and I have made a series of cognitive mistakes about the explanation, or based on beliefs outside of that shared reality. I believe in a flat earth because I believe in God. And in both cases, illusions and bias help build up an erroneous view of what is actually happening. And, you know, skeptics aren't immune to that. So it's important to understand that in general, our brains work the same. And it's a mistake for the atheist or the skeptic to think that we are somehow immune to the cognitive mistakes that other people can make, especially those who have a different worldview, which might be outside of our shared reality. And when doing our own research, it is important to be aware that we can fall prey to biases and even worse, employ cognitive dissonance. You know, if we're looking for a paper on discussing a particular subject, we must guard against cherry picking any information we can sometimes find tempting. That's poor practice. Mm-hmm. That's poor practice. And I think, you know, we're running short, so I think we'll leave it there. But I think I've kind of covered everything in a rudimentary way that I wanted to cover.
I also want to mention that flat earthers think they're skeptics too.
Yeah. Yes,
so,
they do.
You know, so it's all about your perspective, you know, and if we were talking to them, they would say that we were the ones that had fallen into a bad belief. So, you know, it's all about perspective. They're objectively wrong, but they think they're skeptical. So I'm just letting y'all know, you know, you don't think they are, but they think they are.
And as Richard says, we can test that. I feel like Bill Nye said that too.
Yeah.
We can referee these claims.
I'm like, where is your paper? Where's your peer-reviewed paper on flat earth? Where's that?
Speaking of peer-reviewed papers, can I share the list of books and resources that you put in our outline, Richard?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That's what I put on there.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to drop these links to some books in the chat because y'all know I get excited about books. So I want you to be excited about books too, if you want to. There are some books, and then we'll put those in the show notes too. And let's see. Can I share your link as well to your link tree?
Yeah, please do.
All right. Yeah. So please, y'all, find Richard at these places. And we're also going to do Q&A now. So we can also ask questions there. We have quite a few questions piled up. Richard, are you going to be able to stick around at all for the hangout after the
Q&A?
Yeah,
I'll stay around.
Excellent. Okay, great. So if
you're
we don't
trooper,
get to your
Richard.
Question. Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, it's only 2:30 in the morning. What else have I got to do with
you're a
sleep?
Night owl in a way that I do not understand, but that's okay.
I love it. I love it. Well,
I love that
you
about
are
you.
A trooper. Yes. Thank you for being here with us and for answering these questions. This has been fascinating. I'm super excited that we got to spend the evening talking about cognitive bias, and we're not done yet. And I want to start with a question that someone asked in the chat that I think is a really important point that we haven't even covered yet. As you said, we could probably go on about this for hours and hours, but I think this is a great one. They were asking if you could talk a little bit about how bias also impacts marginalized groups of people like women, LGBTQ plus community, BIPOC people. How can you speak a little bit to how our cognitive biases can tend to further marginalize or impact people who are coming from different life experiences, different perspectives, and things like that?
Yeah.
Or what we can watch out for?
I want to be careful and preface this with that I am a very privileged person and don't come from any marginalized group. So it's, you know, I don't have life experience in this, but I think from my perspective, you know, I worked in an industry. I'm just between jobs. I worked in an industry with kind of manly men who kind of said whatever they wanted. And, you know, our biases can, you know, and again, sometimes it's the way we're brought up. Sometimes it's we're aware of the differences, but we can very easily fall prey to kind of going along with kind of group think, and you know, if everyone around us is saying things, you know, I work with a lot of guys, and you know, not one of them claims that they've got any level whatsoever of attraction, same sex attraction. Because they're all manly men, and it's very hard in that kind of in that framework to stand up and say, you know, when derogatory things are being said, you know, well, actually, hang on a minute, I might have that attraction to same-sex attraction. And you know, groupthink is very, very powerful in controlling how we kind of publicly represent. And especially when we want to, if somebody's making derogatory remarks about, if people are othering people, making derogatory remarks. I think sometimes it's our obligation to stand up and challenge that and get out of that groupthink. And I think that for me is the, from the position I'm in, the privileged position I'm in and the kind of circles that I come across, that for me is the best way to challenge that and to override that cognitive bias in those areas by standing up and challenging it and saying, you know, please don't put yourself in any danger by doing this, because I wouldn't want anybody to do that. But that is, I think that's a very powerful thing, because, you know, if you let's take it, say you're in a group of 25 other with all other males and 25, and they're all being derogatory towards a particular group of people. I guarantee that if you stand up, there will be other people in there who actually share your opinions and your disgust for what's been said, but they won't want to come out and say it because of that groupthink that's going on. They're so safe in that group that they don't want to challenge it. And that's how we enact change, by standing up and making our voices heard and saying, you know, we can support others. We can support other people. I had a great argument with someone in a long time ago, a couple of years ago. I think it was Cynthia McDonald and Jenna Meal did a video on safe spaces and atheist Black communities. And somebody in the comments kind of put a remark, something along the lines of, well, you don't really, why do you need a subgroup of a subgroup? And I got into a massive argument with them about that in the comments. And like, afterwards, Jenna and Cynthia afterwards, like, oh, Richard shouted me out on like literally the next four or five things he did, saying, no, Richard's brilliant, Richard. But I think everybody should do that. I think we've got an obligation to do that, to call stuff out. You know, not to the point, as I said, not to the point where we put ourselves in danger, but if it's safe to do so, and I'm in an environment where I'm safe to do that, nobody where I worked or kind of had that mindset is going to, you know, it helps that I'm a bigger guy and kind of ex-professional wrestler. but I'm in a safe position to do that, and I feel that I personally have an obligation to do that, to challenge that when groupthink is going off, and, you know, and people are wanting to feel safe in groups, that, you know, stand up and be countered, and other people will have the same feelings as you, but they just don't want to challenge it. And the amount of times I've done that and people have come up to me and said, you know, we're so glad you stood up and said that, because we agree with you. Well, if you agree with us, let's have a voice together. And, you know, and let's stamp this out all together, because that's the only way we're going to do it. We're not going to do it by being meek and sitting on the edge of a crowd and being quiet. And, you know, sometimes we need a voice, and use that voice if you can.
Yeah,
I don't know if I answered the question. I hope it did. If not, let me know and I'll try and clarify.
No, great point and great reminder. Thank you for doing that. Being a good ally. Yeah. Okay, what else do we have, Helen?
Somebody was asking, why is stating that the Bible is unreliable improper framing?
Say that again.
Why is stating that the Bible is unreliable in proper framing? I think you mentioned it earlier in the talk.
Because there are different ways in which we can read the Bible, and we've got to kind of be aware of when we're in conversation with someone, we've got to be aware of the way that they're reading it. And, you know, you can, if you're talking about, let's say theology. If we're talking about theology, the Bible's going to have much more of a reference to that, and could be correct in informing that than if we're talking about whether it's historically accurate. So we've got to look at the frame of reference from which the person we're talking to is actually coming from, rather than just assuming that they're talking about a certain thing. So we can, if we say in general, the Bible is inaccurate or the Bible is unreliable, then what do we actually mean? what frame of reference are we coming on? We need to specify which frame of reference we're coming on. Because if we're talking about the historicity of the Bible, then it absolutely, it's unreliable. If we're talking about, is it an example of the ancient Near East's way of framing the world and their kind of poetry, then it is a reliable source for looking at that. What frame of reference are we looking at? It's so important to get that frame of reference, and to just make a blanket statement, the Bible is unreliable, it means nothing. It's entirely meaningless in just a general sense. Because it can be unreliable, it can be reliable. It depends on exactly what you're talking about. And I think, as I've banged on about relentlessly during this broadcast, the frame of reference is so important. And, when you've got your frame of reference, when you've agreed on the thing you're actually referring to, then you can legitimately say that's unreliable. If you're talking to a Christian and you say, yes, I'm talking specifically about the historicity of the Bible, and they agree, and you're having that conversation, then you can legitimately say that the Bible is unreliable as a historical document. And in that form of saying the things in the Bible are true. But even then, some things in the Bible actually happened, some didn't. So you've got to use that framing all the time, reset that framing on every different thing you're talking about. And I think it's so important to do that. You can legitimately say that the Bible is unreliable, but you've got to be careful about what it is specifically you're talking about within that context.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. Okay, I think we have time for maybe two more questions, and then we'll go to the Hangout. We'll wrap up and go to the Hangout. So if we don't get to your question, don't worry, you can still ask it. But okay, let's see. I've got another one here. I think this one is a pretty interesting question. This person is asking, when hearing new challenging information, is there a way to differentiate between the bullshit detector sensation when it doesn't fit logically with our understanding versus the dangerous idea situation or sensation we get when we're threatened by the implied consequences and how it might challenge us emotionally? And so how do we know when we don't want to accept a new idea for rational reasons as opposed to psychological reasons?
I don't know if we always do. I think that's where we've got to kind of really dig down and look at it. I think if the key point in there, and I think this is the thing that I'm always trying to do myself, is when you become aware that something is amiss, when that point of awareness comes to bear, then, and maybe this is just because of my meditation background that I do it this way, and maybe there are other methods doing it, but when you become aware that something is amiss and there might be a bias there, then you stop. Use that point of awareness as a stopping point and then investigate it further. Rather, because it's so easy just to, when you become aware of that, just to dismiss that, well, just shove that aside. Let's just put that over there for a bit and carry on as we are. But don't do that. Just use it as a stopper. As soon as you become aware of that, stop. Use that point as a hard stop and then say, right, I'm going to have a look at this closer and I'm going to see exactly what I'm doing here. I'm going to see exactly how I'm framing this information. I'm going to see exactly, what sources I'm looking at, what aspects I'm looking at, whether I agree with the person because they share the same worldview as I do, whether I disagree with them because they don't share the same worldview as I do, whether, even though they don't share the same worldview as I do, are they employing bias or are they being honest? I have kind of this scale I've used between scholars and apologists. It's largely about how they assess the information that they're looking at. And if like I mentioned, I think it was Timothy Luke Johnson earlier, he will openly admit that he doesn't share the consensus of expert opinion. And I think that is the difference between a scholar and an apologist, if we're going to draw a hard line, because an apologist won't admit that. What an apologist will do is disagree with the consensus and run with their own belief system. And I think that, you know, we can all take a lesson from the apologist, probably the only lesson we can ever take from an apologist. And when that arises in ourselves, use that as a hard stop. Use that point where we don't agree, where we see it, we see something amiss within ourselves, as a hard stop point where we can go and use that as a starting block to investigate further.
Great. I agree.
That's a good answer. Yeah. Well said. All right. Helen, do you want to wrap us up with one more question?
Yeah. So this was actually the first question was asked, what does atheism mean to you, Richard?
I don't even refer to myself as an atheist. If I say anything, I'll just say I don't believe in God. Labels are the difficult, because, you know, we have this is actually a good point that I don't really want to go into, but I'm going to, because I've started, so I'll finish. In our community, a lot of people say atheism means this, and there are lots and lots of different definitions of what atheism is. And philosophically, they mean different things to the common dictionary definition, and none of them are wrong. And I think we've got to be careful in saying that atheism means this, and a lot of us in this community say that. And I just prefer not to. I'll use the term atheist if I'm talking to a theist and they say, "Are you an atheist?" I will say yes, because it's easy to do that. But internally, I don't walk around with the label atheist in mind. I just don't believe in a God. And that avoids all the, well, atheism means this and atheism doesn't mean this and atheism means, you know, I just don't believe in God. It's as simple as that. And that's what atheism means to me. I don't believe in God.
So it sounds like you're saying framing is important and you don't want people to get it wrong.
It's funny that, isn't it? Why would you do that?
That's great. And so on that note, let's go ahead and wrap it up, unless you have any final thoughts for us before we wrap up and move to the Hangout.
Be aware of your framing.
Yes. I think that is the takeaway from tonight's episode, and I love it. All righty. Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of great information. I'm excited to go back and review some of those sources as well, especially the books, and to think about them critically as well as I read them, as you have encouraged us to do.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.